We will finish our discussion of mutual funds by taking a look at the industry, fund families, different mutual fund companies. We'll take a look at some of the services that make mutual funds so attractive and easy to invest in. And we'll end by looking at a single mutual fund as a microcosm of the mutual fund industry. Let's get started on slide 61. Fund families. A family of funds exists when one investment company manages a group of mutual funds. Well, this is the norm now. It used to be that companies might have one or two mutual funds, but then as the industry expanded, one company would come out with one type of mutual fund, and then they'd all come out with it, to the point where some of the fund families have dozens and dozens, even hundreds of different funds. Of course, mutual funds in the family, as all mutual funds, vary in their objectives. As we saw in the previous presentation when we looked at all the different types of objectives, and we didn't even look at all of them, we just looked at it at the major categories. You can move your money from one fund to another within a fund family almost always at no charge, but if the fund is in a taxable account, the IRS is going to say, oh, you generated a taxable transaction, so you have to report a gain or a loss. So the mutual fund is not going to charge you again the upfront fee or the whatever, but the IRS is going to say, hey, you know, you've changed investments. You have to report the gain or the loss. However, there's a limit to how often you can move stuff around. Mutual funds typically will charge you a fee for excessive transfers within the fund family. Or they might limit your ability to move. They might say you have to wait a month or you can't move again and for another month. And this was done to discourage market timing, moving in and out. We discussed the scandals of 2003. Well, that was part of it. People were using the mutual fund as timing vehicles. That's not what a mutual fund is designed for, folks. They're long-term investments. You don't move in and out of them on a weekly or a daily basis. And Forbes, a long time ago, said it best, folks. Choose a family, not a fund. Look at the overall family first, and then look at their individual funds and see if they have the right choices for you. Because here are the top 10 mutual funds as of February 2012. And the problem is, it's very hard to get this data because, the companies, you know, they're always getting bigger and smaller and different measures of how big a company is. But by far now, the largest mutual fund family is Vanguard. For decades, Fidelity was the largest. Fidelity is now number three or number two, depending on who does the measuring. American's always been up there, two or three. What happened with Vanguard? Well, they became extremely popular because of their index funds. Indeed, and more people now believe that indexing is the only way to invest. And the vast majority, the plurality of mutual fund inflows are going into one company, Vanguard, which tells me that it's probably the worst thing to do right now. Whenever everybody's moving in one direction in the investment world, it usually means it's not going to end well. But that doesn't mean it won't. Doesn't mean it will. That's just what's happened in the past. And so Vanguard is very different in that it is a member owned. It's a supposedly a non-profit organization. I don't know that I completely believe that, but be that as it may. Fidelity, as we said, was number one for many decades. They're based in Boston, and they have literally hundreds of funds. Vanguard has a, they're getting close to 200, I think. American has about 40. And what we do now in the face-to-face class is we would take a look at the offerings of, I do Fidelity first, and then Vanguard, and then American. Because you go from 500 funds down to 180 or so, down to 40, 30-some, and you just see the tremendous number of choices out there. Just, it's definitely overwhelming. And in the face-to-face class, that's part of the impression I want to leave with the students. Now, in the online class, I have the links in Chapter 4, so you're going to go to the Chapter 4 section of the web page and click on these groups. But by all means, don't just click on the ones I put there. I put Vanguard, Fidelity, American, T. Rowe Price, Franklin, and then I put one that's very different, Dodge & Cox. Dodge & Cox is very different, folks. They have been around since 1931. So they're a long-lived company, but they only have 5 funds. They have resisted the urge to explode. I mean, American is often considered old-fashioned because they only have about 37 or 38 funds. Dodge & Cox is just considered bizarre. But they have some of the best funds in the world, so figure that out. You want to take a look at them. PIMCO. PIMCO, about 10 years ago, 6, 7, 8 years ago, had the largest fund for many years called the Total Return Fund, run by a man, it was a bond fund, it still is a bond fund, run by a man named Bill Gross, who since has just left PIMCO, but he had the kiss of everybody piling into PIMCO funds, and that, I don't know what it is, folks, but that just seems to you know, that's almost a precursor for a fall. It's not the largest fund anymore, my understanding. And that title now belongs to Vanguard, I'm pretty sure. Franklin Templeton is another very good company that deserves your attention. They have some excellent funds. And the we'll discuss Sir John Templeton when we get to stock picking and stock gurus, all stars of investing. T. Rowe Price, another very good company, long-lived, deserve to be up there in the top 10, and they have some excellent funds also. And that both Franklin and T. Rowe Price links are on the class website. Columbia, oh, I feel so sorry for people of Columbia. You know, if you know, I can't say anything good. You're not supposed to say anything. If you can't, right, enough said. BlackRock, very smart company. BlackRock has been around for not as long as the other folks, but just very smart company. They run the TSP for the federal government. And you'll see their fees are very low, but when you have 3 million instant potential customers, you don't need to have high fees to do very well. And so that's part of your assignment, is to look at BlackRock funds. J.P. Morgan Chase is a relative newcomer, but they got there by buying other companies. And then Oppenheimer has some excellent funds also that you want to take a look at. They've been around for quite some time. So now, as I said, in the face-to-face class, we would take a look at the various offerings just from Fidelity, Vanguard, and American, but I want you to go out there and pick a company or pick a mutual fund or a couple of mutual funds and do your research and see what you think about them. And that's the first assignment for Chapter 4. That's the annual report assignment. And I hope you enjoy it. I hope you enjoy it. And it will. I wanted the feeling of I wanted you to have that feeling because That is what investors are up against when they look at the various mutual fund offerings. There are just so many choices, it's mind-boggling. Slide number 63. Let's take a look at the investor services that mutual funds have. And they have made it very easy for you folks. It's one of the really nice things about mutual funds. The PETA factor, as David Chilton, the author of the Wealthy Barber, one of my favorite books on financial planning and investment, he calls it the PETA factor. Pain in the, yeah, right, exactly. And I have a renewed appreciation for it after dabbling in real estate. Automatic investment plans, folks, allow shareholders to automatically send fixed amounts of money from their paychecks or bank accounts into the fund. This is by far the absolute best way to invest in a mutual fund, in my humble opinion. It has a name, which is kind of dumb, but you should really learn it. Dollar cost averaging. A better way to say it is to pay yourself first. You don't worry about whether or not it is a good time to invest, because in your case, every month is a good month, good time to invest $50 or $100. That comes right out of your paycheck or right out of your checking account. And folks, for the vast majority of us working grunts, it's practically the only way we're going to invest. How many of you have $10,000 fall in your lap? Not too often, right? But that's the number. That's the number that the Securities and Exchange Commission assumes that you're going to be investing. That's what they require the mutual funds to show. If you had invested $10,000 in this fund, whatever, 10 years ago, 100 years ago, whatever. And most people just don't have that, especially students at Southwestern Community College or employees of Southwestern Community College. So we put our $100 to more if you can afford it, folks. I'm not limiting you to that amount, but certainly it makes sense to get started and pay yourself first. What is going on here? Slide 64. Automatic reinvestment plan. This is the default. When you open up a mutual fund, they assume you're going to want to reinvest any distributions, dividends, interest, capital gains. They assume you're going to automatically buy additional shares in the fund when the fund distributes, as it's required by law, every year, the dividends, the interest payments, the capital gains. And why? Because this allows an investor to earn fully compounded rates of return, which is what we're interested in, right? Unless the investor needs the income, it is always a good idea to reinvest dividends and capital gains received from your mutual fund. And as I said, that's the default. If you don't want that, if you need to live off the income, then you need to tell the mutual fund company, please do not reinvest the amounts into the mutual fund. Please send me a check, or better yet, have it electronically deposited into my checking account, as we describe on 65, right, slide 65. Once you've put in the money, how do you take it out? Well, you can certainly call them up, go online, and have them send you a check. But most people are going to set up a systematic withdrawal plan that enables shareholders to automatically receive a predetermined amount of money monthly, quarterly. Most people do it monthly because it's electronic. It's transferred directly into your checking account. So, very cool, folks. For 30 years, 40 years, you're going to be putting money into these things. And then for 30 or 40 years, or you millennials, maybe even longer, you're going to have it taken out. And you're going to put $100 or more into the account for 30 or 40 years and then take $2,000 a month out. How's that for a deal? Eh? I think it's cool. Now, the conversion privilege, as we discussed, allows the shareholders to move money from one fund to another within the same family of funds without any penalties or extra fees But if it's not in a retirement account, the IRS assumes that it's a new investment, so you have to report a capital gain or a loss, right? And as we get closer and closer to retirement, as we saw in the previous presentation, we want to move ourselves down the risk versus reward spectrum from very risky stock funds toward more bond-oriented. But we don't want to give up on stocks entirely because we're going to be living, Lord willing, and the crick don't rise. I'm going to see if I can get this right. Inshallah. I hope I said that right. That means Lord willing and the crick don't rise. Si permite el Dios. We're going to be living a long time in retirement, and so we want to still have some stock growth in our retirement. But we want stability of bonds. And we'll discuss these in detail when we get to stocks and bonds. Slide number 66. How do you buy your mutual funds? Well, we already said that you can do it through a broker, directly from the investment company, open-end funds. That's the vast majority of funds. But closed-end funds, you have to buy through a stock exchange. You have to have a brokerage firm. Now, what about ETFs? Well, when ETFs first came out, exchange-traded funds, you had to have a brokerage account. But companies like Fidelity and Vanguard are not stupid. They created brokerage account companies. They're with the name Fidelity. I forget exactly what its name, you know, Fidelity Investments versus Fidelity, whatever. But it's the same company. It's just, they're just different parts of the company. And they allow you to buy the ETFs of Fidelity or Vanguard of Vanguard for free. No commissions. Remember, you're paying an annual operating expense, but it's very, very smart. And because why would you want to put $50 or $100 into an ETF every month when you're going to pay your broker $10 or whatever commission? You wouldn't. But if you go with Fidelity, then you can buy Fidelity's ETFs. If you go with Vanguard, you can buy Vanguard's ETFs without any commission. And as I said in the previous slide, the best way, I think, is automatically. Have it come out of your paycheck, 401k, 403b, employer-sponsored plans, or your checking account automatically. And when you sell, it's the same idea in reverse. You're going to want to have that money, in my humble opinion, automatically dropped into your checking account. And so you don't even have to worry about when's the best time to sell or whatever. You just take the money out as you need it. Cool? Okay. Slide number 67. Tax. Why do you always have to bring up taxes, folks? Well, you know, we always have to think of taxes. There are two types of taxes for regular accounts. There's the income tax, and then there's the capital gains distributions. Now, I'm sorry, did I say income tax? Tax is income. It used to be that dividends and interest payments were taxed as income. But that's not true anymore. And, of course, they're always talking about changing the tax code. But now, for the vast majority of us, the income dividend and the capital distributions are hit at 15%. There's a maximum of 20%, but these are for people making, you know, $400,000 or $500,000. So don't worry about most of us. Most of you listening to this will not worry about that. But some of you might. Congratulations. But it turns out that the Congress says that we want to encourage investment. So we're going to have taxes that are lower than our income tax. Now, there's a controversy over this, folks, because who does it benefit? It benefits the very wealthy. And so you can get into the politics. I don't want to get into the politics, but you know who's on one side, you know who's on the other side. And it's very sad that we have to yell and scream and holler at one another and not deal with the tax code, which is broken, folks. We got to deal with it, but we'll see. Now, here's one thing that tends to bug people. The mutual fund is required by law to distribute the dividends, distribute the dividends, distribute the capital gains. And so you are getting a dividend, you're getting a capital gain. But you don't see that money go into your pocket. You see that reinvested back into the mutual fund. So you have to pay taxes on that if it's not in a retirement account. If it's in a retirement account, you don't pay anything because you wait until retirement. But some people get really angry, especially if the mutual fund goes down. It goes down and they still have to report these dividends and capital gains and pay taxes on them. So they yell at their Congress representatives, and the Congress every once in a while talks about changing it so that unrealized capital gains would not be taxed until your mutual fund shares are sold. Forget it, folks. This would make the accounting even much more difficult. It would just be a nightmare. So that's not going to happen. It's not going to be an issue until you have a whole lot of money in your account, in which case, congratulations. I don't feel too bad for you. In fact, I hope that is your problem later on after you've been investing, that you have too much money in your account. The retirement accounts, 401ks, Roth IRAs, whatever, they are very different because you don't pay any taxes until you retire. And then if it's a pre-tax 401k or traditional IRA, the proceeds are taxed as if they were income. Well, you got a tax break going in, and you have to pay taxes on the way out. If you choose the Roth option, and why is it called Roth? After the gentleman, the senator, William Roth, who pushed the idea back in the late 90s. If you pay the taxes now, put the money into a Roth IRA, a Roth 401k, you take the money out. Of course, you're not going to be taxed on the amount you put in because you've already been taxed on that. But you would not be taxed on the gains. Very cool option. I'm a big fan of the Roth IRA. There's the phone. My apologies. And I'm not picking it up. Slide 68. The mutual fund prospectus. This is that most important document that describes the risk factors, the fund's past performance, the types of investments in the fund's portfolio, the information about dividends, distribution, and taxes, and the mutual fund management company, and nobody reads them. I know. They, as a representative, as a registered representative, a.k.a. stockbroker, financial rep, or whatever you want to call us, we are required to give you a prospectus. And nobody reads them. Literally, my boss didn't even read them. At the brokerage firm I first worked at, I was very worried about investing, and so I didn't want to invest individual stocks. And I told her how, you know, I just thought that there was a lot of crooks out there that you know, I didn't want to lose money. Nobody does. So she showed me a very good mutual fund that had been around a long time, and it's the one I'm going to show you. And I read the prospectus cover to cover, and I came back and said, do you have the prospectus for the other one you mentioned, the Washington Mutual? Because I want to read that. And she looked at me like I had three eyes in the middle of my forehead and said, you read the prospectus? I said, yeah. I said, I want to make sure I'm going to invest in this. I want to make sure that I understand it. And she just looked at me. She said, I don't know anybody's ever read a prospectus. I've never read a prospectus. So it shows you. Now, she's retired, but it just shows you that nobody looks at these things, but they're very important. And I pass them out in the face-to-face class, and I have the on the website links to various prospectuses. Now we don't even pass them out in paper form anymore. You just click on this little box on the website that says that you've read the prospectus. You know the drill. You read the risk factor. Yeah, right. Yeah, nobody reads them. And they're not that hard, but they are useful, as we said, for when we looked at the hypothetical illustrations, which I'm going to discuss in just a few moments. They're very useful if you have insomnia. You read a prospectus and very quickly you will fall fast asleep. The more important document for the vast majority of us is the mutual fund annual report. That is where the mutual fund tells you how they did this past year, past 5, 10, 20 years, and discusses the performance, the investments, has all the accounting information in the back. And this is very important, in my humble opinion. That's part of your assignment. Part of your assignment is to go pick out a mutual fund annual report. There are links on the website so you can download them. I have some in my office if you want to stop by and borrow one. Some of them are very well written, easy to understand, very frank and honest about their performance. Others are extremely obfuscated. That means they're trying to hide something, folks. Difficult to penetrate. And the reason is because they're not trying to tell you how badly they did. So, be careful. But you do want to read the prospectus and the annual report, right? If you're going it alone. I mean, if you have an advisor who is recommending, you still should read them anyway, but at least the advisor, you're trusting the advisor's expertise. But you still want to read it anyway. Slide number, and that's your assignment, by the way, so you're going to wind up reading one before the class. Slide number 69. How about the industry? Well, the financial publication industry wants to sell newspapers. They want to sell advertisements. They want to sell what they, on the websites, eyeballs. So they are chock filled with articles that are just, I think, very sensationalist and of dubious usefulness. So you have to be careful. Every year they come out with their mutual fund issue and they're discussing the ratings of the different companies and mutual funds and comparing them to other companies, looking at the sizes, the charges, the expense ratios. And they'll go back 3, 5, and 10 years. Well, I like to go back 20, 30, 50 years. That's a little harder to do. You have to go to the individual mutual funds. But by all means, don't discount these people. The two most popular companies are Morningstar and Lipper. Morningstar is by far the more popular one, the more populist. And they get things spectacularly wrong, folks. They came up with a star rating system, and it is now a cliche. It's a joke that a mutual fund that gets a 5-star the next year gets a 1-star because they just go back 1 year. And I think they've changed it so that they've smoothed out the rating system. But how could that be? Well, if you take huge risks and 1 year you do well, you're going to get 5 stars. And then if you, all of a sudden, your run of bad luck occurs, you wind up with next year with 1 star. So even Morningstar agrees that they need to change things or they have changed things. I don't follow them that much, so I don't really know. But their website does have some good information that you might want to use. Lipper is the older one and the more staid. They you have to pay for if you want to use their website. But you go to the library and you can pick up the Morningstar and the Lipper information for free. That's what libraries are for. Slide number 70. The financial websites that we are discussed, Morningstar. But, Yahoo used to be the best financial website out there, folks, but it's gotten bad. And it just keeps getting worse. And I'm not the only one who thinks this. I've talked to other people say, yeah. So you decide. Businessweek, not bad. Bloomberg, we'll discuss these later when we get to chapter 5. But the mutual fund websites have gotten very good. When the internet started to explode in the late 90s, the mutual fund websites started to invest heavily. And they had tremendous resources. I loved the Vanguard University they had. And then I think the SEC must have just told them, hey, cool your jets. We don't want you doing this. And because they scaled back. They scaled back all the education that they were promoting. I guess the Securities Exchange Commission said, you know, that you're not financial advisors. You're just a mutual fund company. I don't know. I don't know what happened. But now they've come back and they have much more educational materials. T. Rowe Price's website is excellent. Franklin Templeton's website is excellent. Oppenheimer's is pretty good. I don't have that down on here, but Oppenheimer's is pretty good. And American and Vanguard Fidelity certainly are not slouches. Dodge and Cox used to have a semi-annually video conferencing videos that were tremendous. And now I've noticed that they haven't had them in a while, so it's all print material now. I guess it was just getting very expensive. But still, it's very good stuff. Now, if you are into statistics, what's it called? Statistics. You want to take a look at ICI.org. That's the mother lode. That's the Investment Company Institute. This is the trade nonprofit group for the industry because they have too much. You know, it's hard to get your arms around it because it's raw data. And some of it is quite good for educational purposes, but not so much. So if you type mutual fund into any search engine, you're going to probably get 10 billion hits, right? That's how big the industry is. So, I know it's overwhelming. And we come to the question. It's the end of the day. We've got to make a choice. How do I pick a mutual fund? Well, my advice to people is the following. You want to pick a mutual fund that invests in high quality stocks or bonds. Well, there you go. How do you define quality? You know, it's not easy. And that's what we're going to look at in our next chapter. We're going to start the process of identifying what are high quality stocks and bonds. So that's not easy. It's well diversified across several industries and sectors of the economy. You don't want, in my humble opinion, mutual funds that concentrate. They may do very, very well, like good old Bill Miller's Legg Mason Value Trust, until they don't do very, very well, like Legg Mason Value Trust. You want diversification. That's why you buy a mutual fund. You want a mutual fund that has a long-term perspective and a manager, or better yet, in my humble opinion, a management team with many years of experience. You want to avoid companies that shuffle their managers every few years like a deck of cards, which I write here is virtually all of them, but the industry got it, folks. They seem to have figured this out, that it wasn't the best way to run things. So I guess I don't follow that many because you just can't. But this was Fidelity's way of this was the old man of Fidelity. He would just throw people into the mix and see how well they did. He wanted that constant turmoil. And if they did great, they got to stay. And if they didn't do well, got somebody else. But that not necessarily in the best interest of the shareholder, is it? And it turns out that that is not as popular as it was in the past. So look for companies that have a long-term perspective and have been around for decades and performed consistently well in both good and bad markets. When people say, oh, I got this great mutual fund I wanted you to take a look at. It's done really, really well. What I say is, look, don't tell me how well you've done in good times, because I'm not interested. I am not interested. What I'm interested in is how well you did during the bad times, because that's what's going to, in my humble opinion, determine your better long-term returns, because that's when the emotions kick in. And you have to be able to hang on. And if you have a roller coaster ride and have lost a ton of money, It is very difficult to hold on. It's just very difficult. I want companies that do well in good times, sure, but more importantly, have done well in bad times. And so here in the face-to-face class is when I would pass out some material for a single mutual fund. Well, I don't have it for you. I apologize. But what I did do is take the stuff that we look at and put it on the website. So it's called the Investment Company of America, commonly called ICI. It's one mutual fund out of 10,000, but it's been around for over 80 years. And remember we said 8, 9, 10% is what we're looking for? How about 12? They've done 12%. Not bad. Not bad and pretty darn good. And so using the materials in this one piece, we ask questions and we say certain statements such as stocks are very risky. And there's a piece called, what's it called? I forget. But it shows you how well you had done over 1, 3, 5, and 10 years. And shows you that in the short term, yes, stocks are very risky. But in the long term, no. Assuming the world doesn't end and that capitalism is still around, which, you know, it could be the worst possible economic system in the world, except for all the others. When something better comes along, let's be sure to give it a try, but it doesn't look like it's coming along anytime soon. If we have a long-term perspective, we should do well. And you will also take a look at the time versus timing, the best day and the worst day. You'll hear people say, but now's not a good time to invest. When is it ever a good time to invest? The time that it feels good to invest, when the market's done really well over a certain amount of time, 5, 10 years or whatever, in the case of the late 90s, it was 20 years. That's the worst time to invest, it turns out, historically. Not a guarantee. And so we take a look at what would happen if you invested on the best day or if you invested on the worst day. And it turns out the difference isn't that great. I mean, it's a difference, but it's not that big. And what about market downturns? Well, what about them? They're going to happen. You're going to take a look at some illustrations on the website, and you're going to see the 80 years. I want you to take a look at that, folks. ICA, 81 years of investing. You're going to see that it's there are some times when you get kicked in the gut, when you get slapped across the head. But what you need to do is keep a long-term perspective. And there's that phrase I want you to learn, dollar cost averaging. So you promise you're going to go look at these things, okay, because it's important. I'm not telling you should go out and buy ICA. No, that's not what I'm telling you. What I'm showing you is a sample mutual fund, and there are many others like it. Slide number 73, dollar cost averaging. Now, this is what makes mutual fund investing so excellent. And basically easy from a standpoint of the investor, once you've picked a good mutual fund or mutual funds, is dollar cost averaging. It is a system of buying an investment at regular intervals with a fixed dollar amount. Now, I know that's probably the most boring definition you can imagine, and you're going to have a hard time remembering it. But it means putting $50, $100 a month out of your checking account, out of your paycheck, or more if you can afford it, right? And this is the very cool part about dollar cost averaging. No matter what happens tomorrow when you wake up, there's good news. I would tell my wife that many years ago. She was very worried about stocks when we met, and I've already indoctrinated her. But when I was indoctrinating her, I would tell her, no matter what happens tomorrow, we have good news. The market's up. Good news. Yippee. Your account is worth more. The market's down. Good news. What? DeMarcus Dam, that's good news. Yes. Especially for you millennials. Now, once you're, you know, once you're in your 60s and 70s, you don't feel the same way. So you have to have a much smaller exposure to stocks. But still, when the market's down, that is good news because, right, they're on sale. You're going to get more shares at a lower price when the $50 or $100 comes out of your paycheck or your checking account. Yes, you want to buy them on sale. That's why I tell millennials, I say, the best thing for you is if the market crashes. And they look at you with this this deer in the headlights look. Are you insane? No, I'm not insane. What happens when JCPenney's or Macy's has a 50% sale off? What happens? Everybody runs in the store. What happens when the stock market has a 50% sale? Everybody runs out the door. They can't get out fast enough. That's the wrong way to think, folks. And emotional issues kick in, and we want to run for the hills. No mas, no mas, no quiero mas. But if we hold on, we're going to get more shares at a lower price. And the upstart, or the takeaway, is that your average cost per share should be lower than your average price per share. Now, I'm going to ask you to memorize that, and you're probably not going to do it, and we're going to come back to it much later. But it is a very cool system. You're going to wind up paying less per share than the price because you're going to be buying fewer shares when the price is down. I'm sorry, fewer shares when the price is up and more shares when the price is down. Is it a guarantee? You already know what I'm going to answer, right? There are no guarantees, right? There are no, unless you get a government-sponsored savings account or a money market fund where they're not guaranteed, but they're pretty darn close. When you invest in stocks and bonds, there are no guarantees. But it is a very cool system, very cool. Now, slide number 74, hypotheticals. How are we doing for time? Not bad. Most mutual fund companies have a system for running what are called hypotheticals, illustrations, hypothetical illustrations. Life insurance companies do the same thing. They are examples of returns of investments on either a lump sum principal, single payment, or a stream of investments, a series of deposits, or dollar cost averaging, is just another word for it, or combinations of both. Now, these must be approved by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, and contain disclaimers about past versus future performance. And they can only be administered by registered representatives. And this is why if you call the mutual fund company, they might hem and haw and say, well, we don't do that, because the person who's talking to you is not a registered representative. They'd have to have one call you and walk you through it. So that's, but most of them will. They'll say, oh, okay. Or some of them, what they'll do is they'll say, you know what? We deal through brokers. Here's some brokers in your area. Call them and they will run them for you. Some companies will do that. So now in the face-to-face class, we would pop to the website and go through these. You are going to go to the class website and go through them. There's one for Investment Company of America for all 81 years if it's been in existence. And it's pretty darn impressive, folks, but that's 81 years. You don't have 81 years, or maybe you do, you millennials, who knows, you know, 140, 150. The first person who's going to live to 150 has supposedly been born. We'll see. I mean, I won't see it. I'll be gone. But, we ran the hypotheticals for 30 years at $100 a month, 40 years at $100 a month, and then 40 years at $100 a month, increasing $10 a month every year, so 110 the next year, 120. And then we ran it for 20 years for you baby boomers. Oof, not good. Take a look at those. And if you want any other hypotheticals, please contact me. I can run them any kind of combination you want. Slide number 75. by all means, by just showing you the Investment Company of America, I am not saying you should invest in the Investment Company of America, ICA. What I'm saying is here's an example of one that's done well over decades. But here are a couple dozen others, folks. Every single one of these mutual funds has been around for 50 years or longer. Look, 1950, 1931, 1965, 1930, 58, 48. There's the Investment Company of America that we took a look at, 1934. And you'll notice some names that I've already mentioned. Dodge and Cox, Fidelity, Franklin, MFS. They have the oldest, the nation's oldest mutual fund, I think in 1924. Oppenheimer, mutual fund, mutual shares is part of Franklin. And Templeton is part of Franklin. T. Rowe Price. Dreyfus has been around for a good long time. Putnam. Putnam was one of the companies that was implicated in the 2003 scandals. Poor George Putnam rolling around in his grave. And then there's Vanguard. Vanguard snuck in there. Now, where's American? Because I've mentioned American. Well, American doesn't really start their names with American. Washington Mutual Investors Fund, Investment Company of America, and American Mutual Fund are those entries into their into this very august collection of mutual funds. And so I'm not saying you should invest in these individual mutual funds, folks. I'm just showing you that there have been companies that have done very well over the long term. Look at T. Rowe Price's small cap stock fund. 13%. But what do we know about small companies? Exactly. You got to put up with the volatility. So I think this is a good sign for the future, don't you? Again, if I get 8-9%, I'm sitting pretty. I'm a happy man. But boy, wouldn't you like to get 11-12? Yeah, wouldn't you love to get that over the long term? Yay. Slide number 76. But what about the investors? Now here's a paradox, folks. It turns out that investors don't do as well as the mutual funds they invest in. It's a saying in the industry, and now it's been shown by a company called, Dunbar. They've shown that mutual fund investors get a much worse return than the mutual funds they invest in. Why? Because they do exactly the wrong thing. They wait until the market has done really well, and then they say, ooh, is it too late to get in? They buy in August 1987, when the market's gone up 40% in the first 8 months of the year. And then 3 months later, when the market falls in half, they sell. And they buy in 1999, when we're partying like it's 1999. And then in 2001 and 2, they sell. To 2007, they buy. 2008, they run for the hills, never to come back again until 2014, 2000 now, and when the market's at near a high. So you do not want to be the investors that do worse than the mutual funds they invest in. You see, what this graph is showing you is that as the market does well, the cash flow starts coming in. And so here's how well the market did, right? Here are the inflows. The market does poorly, what happens? People start taking their money out at the worst possible time. The market does get well again, what do people do? They start putting money back in. The market tanks, what do? They take it out. And it's a cliche. It just shows how, I don't want to use the word stupid, but it shows how badly people invest, given their own choices. They allow emotions to take over. When emotions have shown us that the best time to invest is the time when you feel like you've been punched in the gut. The worst time to invest is when you're giddy and happy. And look at that. 2008 was such a huge drop that the mutual fund inflows didn't start coming back until now. And this graph ends at the near the end of 2013. This is just till 2012. And 2013 was a very good year for stocks. The inflows started coming back in again. People started putting money back into mutual funds. So what does that mean? It means we're due for a crash, right? We're due for a downturn. But don't let that stop you from investing. Just realize that you can't guess when it's going to happen. And when it does happen, keep putting your $50 and $100 a month in. It's like clockwork. You just don't know when. You know, I shouldn't use the word clockwork. It's very predictable. You just can't predict when it's going to happen. You know it's going to happen. You just can't say, you don't know when. People with me, is there going to be a crash? And I say, oh, yeah, there's going to be a crash. And they go, well, oh, what should we do? Take our money out. When's it going to happen? I go, I don't know. I don't know when it's going to happen. I know it's going to happen. History tells us it's going to happen. I know people are going to bid up the prices to outrageous amounts. And then it's going to crash. And then people will stay away from the market for a while. It'll come back. And then, yeah. Slide number 77. What's the bottom line? Well, the bottom line, folks, is to choose a fund family and stick with them. Reevaluate your mutual funds periodically, once or twice a year. Don't look at them every day. You will drive yourself insane. But make changes judiciously and sparingly. You like that word, judiciously? As you approach retirement, migrate from stocks to bonds. But don't give up on stocks entirely. We'll discuss this later when we get to asset allocation. Dollar cost average. $50 a month, $100 a month, whatever you can afford for you. But for the most part, forget about them. That's why you're paying somebody to manage your money for you. Don't be one of the mutual fund investors that does worse than your mutual funds. And you won't be. Because you've been done educated, right? And if you want to sell, call me up and I'll talk you off the ledge, okay? Slide number 78, we are done with mutual funds. Our next chapter, we're going to dive into the wonderful world of stocks, folks. And you are going to be amazed at how really easy it is to understand these things. But how hard it is to pick them. As Warren Buffett likes to say, investing is simple, but it ain't easy. See you in our next chapter.